friends, Tillery Tim and Sims here again with another episode of Conservation Stories. Conservation Stories, as you know, is put on production by the Sandhill Area Research Association, Sarah, as we like to call it. And we have another return guest with us today, and that would be Leah Doozy. And Leah was here earlier, and we talked about pesticides, and it was actually wildly popular on YouTube. So we obviously had other things to discuss, which normally happens when we have guests on. So I'm so glad that you're back, and I would love to hear what's going on. Let's give people a reminder, Leah, of who you are, who you work with, what you do, and then we'll roll into talking about some endangered species.
That sounds great. Thank you. It's always a pleasure. It's great to be back. I'm Leah Doozy. I'm a principal consultant with Compliance Services International. We're an environmental and regulatory consulting company that works out of we're based out of Lakewood, Washington, but we also have an office in Scotland, and we're kind of scattered across the United States. I am lucky to call Auburn, Alabama home. So I am in the Southeast.
Beautiful.
Which is where I've called home for a long time now. Most of my work is in the space of where pesticides and endangered species intersect. So working with pesticide companies to make sure that their labels are addressing the regulations that EPA has put forth as it relates to meeting their obligation under the Endangered Species Act. But I'm also an economist, which is sort of a strange thing to be in this space. And so I do a little bit of economics work.
Well, I think it's actually it's a great crossover, because so much of the regulations can impact your bottom line. It really can.
Well, and growers are across the country are faced with really tight margins right now. That USDA Ag Outlook is going on this week, and that's definitely a topic of conversation, is what do margins look like for growers going into this growing season? And so I think that how people address their expenses, which is right at the forefront of their mind. So if there's additional requirements to use pesticides, then, and it's going to cost them additional dollars, then that's something that they're concerned with.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So I'm excited. You mentioned a while ago that you're going to be at Commodity Classic, and we will be too.
Very exciting.
We'll be over there at the old NASA booth pretending we know something about space.
Well, I always like to come by and get the posters that you have at the NASA booth, because they're always a hit with my children.
The swag is really cool at that booth.
Yes,
it really
I would
is.
Agree.
It's really fun. Last year they had some books. I brought a book home for my nieces and nephews. So fun. So fun. Really cool. Okay, so there have been some changes recently. And I think we recorded probably early summer.
Okay. Yep.
Last year. And so we met and visited in April. So it was probably even maybe May-ish when we actually recorded. But lots of changes have happened, and even more just recently.
Well, yeah. So EPA has been very busy over the last few months, and they, at the end of last year, so they've finalized what they call their herbicide strategy, their insecticide strategy, and their rodenticide strategy. And that's what they're now applying to pesticide labels that are being registered. So for people who are looking at the products that they're going to be using coming out of this for this next growing season, they may, especially for new products, they may start to see some different information and requirements on the labels than they have seen historically. And
okay, does this happen at the every time there's an administration change?
It doesn't. No, this has actually been going on since 2022. And
okay,
so
been
this is just
on it.
This is just a continuation of what EPA was working through. And a lot of it is driven by litigation. So there was a large mega suit that a decision came out in 23. So that's really driving a lot of this is EPA's, they have to meet their obligations under the Endangered Species Act. And that is because registering pesticides, like I think I mentioned before, is a federal action. So because it's a federal action, That means EPA is obligated under the Endangered Species Act to consult with Fish and Wildlife and the NOAA Marine Fisheries on any decision they make. So this is a continuation that started really in 22, and it's just kept moving because they have to meet these court deadlines. That's not the right word, but these court deadlines.
So as so I wonder if, like, as the administration changed, like, those people have stayed. I mean, as much as we've had DOGE go through, like, some of those people left and other people have come in, or like, if that's impacted the final outcome.
I don't think it's impacted the final outcome because the strategies themselves had been in the works. So how they were going to register herbicides and how they were going to register insecticides. I think it probably impacted the speed. We did see a slowdown in some of the decisions that were coming out, but I think that things have continued to move, which is great. It's great for growers so they have access to the products that they need. But we've seen some continue. It's just kind of continuing
Yeah,
the
that's nice
work
to
that had
know.
started.
It's nice to know that there's some continuity, even across, as administrations change. That's good, because otherwise it's like you just never know what's, going to happen 1 year to the next, or 4 years to the next.
I think the workload on individuals, because there has been a reduction in force, and so I think the workload on people at EPA is the people who are still there. Is heavy, but they are trying to meet their deadlines, which I appreciate.
That's cool. That's cool. So, we earlier were talking about, like, what to tackle today and talking about things. So, let's go back and revisit that with people listening in now.
Yeah, absolutely. So if the person listening is a person that works with growers, I think that the best thing to do, and this is we were at the National Association of Independent Crop Consultants or NAICC a couple of weeks ago, and so we did a lot of talking to consultants who work with growers, and it's really understanding what's coming. So you might not be using, say, Liberty Ultra, which has gone through the process, or some of the other products that have gone through this process and now have these mitigations on the labels, but knowing what they are. So go ahead, read those labels, even if you don't think that your growers are going to use them. Read those labels, understand the changes, understand what EPA is talking about when they talk about runoff and erosion mitigation points, right? If you don't know what that means, ask the questions. There's a lot of resources out there from different organizations that are really working to help growers, applicators, crop consultants understand that. Like, that's one of the things that's really going to be highlighted at Commodity Classic next week. There's going to be different information at booths throughout the conference about different parts of pesticide labels. So going to meetings, talking to people, it's in the popular press, so there are articles about it that have been coming out. I think that we've really seen an uptick in the information that's out there about the process and about the changes that we're going to start seeing on pesticide labels that are going to be on the shelf come spring with spring planting.
So, are these pretty major changes? What kind of changes are we talking about?
So it depends on the product. So it's broken down into two different kind of component, three different components. The first is spray drift. And so I think a lot of growers are used to having buffers from sensitive areas, but now there's just different discussions about it. So there's ways that you can reduce those buffers. So if you're using new technology, say you're using new nozzles that have a coarse droplet size, or you're using a hooded sprayer, or you've invested in windbreaks around sensitive areas, you can reduce that buffer. So instead of having to have, say, a 200-foot buffer, maybe you can reduce that buffer. That would include a drift reducing agent, so using an additive to those products to keep them from moving. So that's kind of the first component is drift. And I think a lot of growers and applicators in particular are very comfortable in that space, right? They understand drift, right? It's not new. They know nobody wants their product to leave their land because they're losing money. So I think that's pretty standard. It's just a little bit different language. And then the biggest component that's new is runoff and erosion mitigation points. And so that's trying to get at how you manage your land, how you're applying the product on your land to keep your soil from moving, right? So whether that's through water erosion or through, moving off your field. So that would be things that we're familiar with, like cover crops, conservation tillage. So EPA basically, based on the product, they'll assign a number of points. So it might be a 3-point product. It's not going to be any more than 9 points. That would be the max, but products are going to have different points. And then they point you to what's called the EPA mitigation menu. And it gives you, they have tools to help you figure it out. It gives you a number of points. It gives you different activities that you can have, you can identify that you've already been doing to get to those points, or maybe you might need to do more.
Okay.
And so for, I always like to use my family as an example. My family farms in Georgia, probably a little bit different than all of Texas, but we do have steeper land. We have highly erodible land. So part of the points are based on where you're located. So if you're located in a county that doesn't have a huge runoff issue, you would get some what they call mitigation relief points. So you may, that's, I think of it as your baseline. So you may start off at say 3 points, let's just say, or 2 points.
Okay.
So my family farms in a county where we're going to start off at 2 points.
Okay.
And then you add to that. So we look, we're already doing no-till, so that would be more points. We're already doing cover crops, so that would be more points. So it's really based on how you're managing your operation of being able to get to those points.
And each label will have a certain number, and you have to get to that number. But when you're using it, it's like, okay, this is a number 12. Do you say, but nine is probably the
nine
highest.
Is the max. Yeah.
Okay. So nine's the max. So it, I'm using something that's a nine, and, and I've started at a four. I've got to do five more things basically.
Yeah. They're all the mitigation practices are different levels of points, right? So you might have like no-till, for example, would be 3 points.
Okay.
So that would be a 3-point practice. So
it
just depends. And not every product's going to have points. It really depends
oh,
on
okay.
is run, you know, we look
at. It seems
at,
like a simple, like a, this seems kind of smart. I don't know.
That's the approach that EPA has taken. And so it, not every product will have points. Like if it doesn't, if runoff and erosion is not a route of exposure that's a concern, then it wouldn't have those runoff points. So like both with drift and runoff, that's based on is the potential for exposure from drift or runoff or a combination of both. So you could have spray drift buffers and runoff points on the same label, but it is product specific.
Okay. Yeah. And so, the drift also has a point system.
No, it's it's just it's a foot, like they're different different. I'm sorry, I'm stuttering over myself. Different distances, so it could be and they're trying to,
yeah. Gotcha.
So it could be
gotcha,
a 10-foot buffer or a 30-foot buffer or a 300-foot buffer,
right?
So it just depends,
Okay.
And then the third component is what we call geographically specific mitigations, and those are. There will be a statement on the label that tells you to go to Bulletins Live 2. And so it's a website that EPA has that it's been there for a long time because other previous products had geographically specific mitigations. And so you can go there, you zoom into your farm, you choose your product, and you see if you have any additional mitigations that you might have to do above what's on the label to protect the species in that geographic area.
And that's
so
been there.
Are,
that's really interesting.
Yep.
So, wow.
I think the first ones that were out there for, we call that they're called pesticide use limitation areas, or people will say PULAs or PULAs, but it's pesticide use limitation areas through Bulletins Live 2 or BLT.
Okay.
And I think the first ones to show up were some rodenticides. That's when they first started using BLT. It is a web app now, but at some point, that's why it's Bulletins Live 2, like TWO, is the second version. So there were paper bulletins to begin with, but now it's all online. So there have been the Pacific Northwest, California, they've had pesticide use limitation areas specifically related to the salmon for a very long time.
Oh, yes.
Like this that isn't, So this is new. I think this is new to the central United States.
Yes.
It's not new to the coast.
Right,
They
right,
have
right,
been
right.
aware. Yeah.
Yeah, because they're the first that really the first that were impacted.
Yep.
And I mean, I guess the impact is felt faster there.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. They, and that's where, so they have a different, they have some different challenges, I would say, related to application and how they have to, access EPA's documents. And they have to look at both their, they have the pesticide, the bulletins lab too is extremely important because they have a lot of pesticide use limitation areas and a number of products that reference that. So we expect to see the language to go to BLT on every outdoor use label. There may be some exceptions, but for the most part, almost whether or not there's a bulletin or not, whether or not there is a pesticide use limitation area, EPA wants people to go and check. So you can check, this is, and this is really important. I think you ask what people can do. You can check 6 months in advance of application. So up to 6 months in advance. So you could think about what you're going to apply six months from now. You could go on and look that up right now. See if you have a pesticide use limitation area. I would save that document so that you can show you look, you can download it, and then you're good for whatever that application is that you were going to do of that product.
So you, so it's like I know we have pesticide license, pesticide use license, and people have to take CEUs, and so just for people to know, like it's like people aren't just like willy nilly throwing stuff out there. And so, so farmers really have to be, they have to be educated and know how trained, how to use it and all kinds of pesticides and stuff. And so this is just part of that.
Yes.
If they were ever audited, is that the right word?
Yeah. And that, a lot of that depends on, you know, EPA does the, EPA sets the regulation, right? Like they're the ones who register that product, but pesticide labels are implemented and enforced at the state level, right?
State
so
level.
EPA is not the one enforcing those pesticide labels. That is done by the state lead agency. So in Texas, it's probably your Texas Department of Agriculture. So that's done by that state lead
agency.
That's
who licensed. That's who the licenses come from.
And so those would be the people that would be verifying that pesticide applicators are meeting those requirements on the label. And that's been true forever, right? Like that's ever since they had licensing. And so that's how it's done prior to this strategy. And so it's just this, people ask that question all the time. Like, how is this going to be enforced? And it's like, well, it's going to be enforced how pesticide labels have always been enforced in your state. So this is on those state lead agencies to determine what kind of documentation growers need to keep, if any, and then how they enforce those labels.
So, and we may have, I don't remember if we talked about this in the last podcast or not, if we have, I've slept since then, but, so to me, part of drift is that's not within control of a farmer's hand is volatilization. Like farmers and really can't prevent that.
They can, depending on when they apply. So there are some there, especially on products that maybe have some issues with volatilization. There are some strategies that growers can use based on temperature, based on, you know, at nighttime, there's the risk of volatilization. So there are best management strategies. And you're going to see those on labels where you have volatilization concerns or exposure through volatilization is some of those best management practices that growers can do to help. There's new products that can be added called VRAs that help to reduce that volatilization risk. So there are definitely best management. That is not my area of expertise, but I do know there are, there are best management practices and that is going to be showing up on labels where you have those volatilization issues.
Well, I know, and I've seen some reports of, you know, some of those volatilization, some of those chemicals actually, you know, being in rainwater in our region, you know? And so I think it's important for people to recognize, you know, that it, you know, it really is, it does make a difference.
And I think those, that knowing what those best management practices are and applying them in a way that, and I think that's true for any use of products, but that's also true for fertilizer. It should be true for the people who use pesticides and fertilizers in their
in their
yards.
yard.
Like, yes,
Yes.
it should
Yes,
be
exactly.
applicable to everybody, is that there are best, that's why the label has label language around PPE. They have label language around when to
Right.
use the product, when not to use the
Right.
product. And that is regardless of use site. That doesn't matter if you're a farmer or a homeowner or a golf course.
Right.
They all
Right.
have to meet those. We should
Right.
be following those labels because
Right.
they
Yes.
are the law.
Right. Well, and a lot of times, like, I think people don't realize, like, they think that a pesticide, like, the problems are out on the farm when actually they're more concentrated in town.
I think that there's not as much of an understanding, I think, by
Yeah.
the average homeowner, let's say,
Right.
as there is by a grower, because they are, if I want to go out and spray my poison ivy, I am unlikely to be checked, right? I don't have to have a license.
Right.
Nobody's going to come and check me. But for a grower, they do have to have a license. They, especially if they're using a restricted use pesticide
Right.
or RUP, then they definitely have to keep their records. So I think that the emphasis on following a label and the what growers and applicators have to go through to keep those records is very
Yes.
different than, and even for golf courses, they have their own set of requirements around their
Requirements.
best management practices. But I think for the homeowner space, and I will say, if you're using a commercial applicator, like if you have a company come and spray your yard,
Yes, yes,
then
yeah.
they have to
They're
have
aware.
pesticide license. They have to have all of those things. But
Right.
I would say the average homeowner, I
Yes.
would be guessing, but my hypothesis is most homeowners don't open that label on the back of their product to see what PPE they should be wearing and what how
Yeah.
they should be applying that product. They should. I would
Yes.
encourage you. I get my neighbors to do it, but I don't
Yeah.
think that most people under because they don't understand pesticide regulation, right, or registration, why it's on the back of their product, and it's on
Right.
there to protect themselves and the environment.
Yeah. That's really, really interesting. And I think I didn't know and understand until recently. I was studying some water conservation efforts that are happening in the Snake River, along the Snake River, and there, and then also in Utah. There's a lake in Utah where I think I can't remember it's what river runs and basically ends in this lake in Utah, and the mercury that is in. It's from runoff. I mean, like, and so I guess, most of my life I've gone, oh, whatever, like that's not a real deal. And but then it's like, oh my goodness, like you can't eat the fish from this certain place because we have this ag, the runoff from these farms. And so they are, identifying those places and helping farmers convert it to different types of irrigation that are preventing that runoff, you know what I mean? And so there's great solutions for it, but I do think it is important to be aware that there's labels. The labels aren't there because environmentalists are wackos. I mean, some people are environmentalists, wackos, some of them are, but they're there because there's legit dangers around those things.
Yeah, EPA has a long, I mean, that's why we have pesticide registration, right? Is
Right.
because EPA has a long history now of being able to make sure that those labels are protective so that growers or whoever is the end user can still use those products safely, both for themselves, for the humans around them, for the environment, so that they can be, and there are definitely mitigation options to do that. I think irrigation is a great option, a great example, because I think there's this idea that runoff isn't, that because you irrigate, it's somehow that runoff doesn't happen, and that's just not true, right? Because you can over
Right.
irrigate, you can
Right.
cause erosion with irrigation, right? Like, whereas with a dry land farmer, you're only going to have erosion if it rains, right? But with an irrigated farmer, you can over irrigate to the point of saturation, and then you are going to have runoff that you are actually causing. And
Right.
so
Right.
I think the strategies in another part of my life, I do work in, I look at irrigation strategies to minimize runoff. And so looking at drop nozzles and using different technologies to determine exactly how much water you need and variable rate irrigation. There is a lot of really great technologies out there, but they also involve capital investment, right? They
Exactly.
require you to
Yes.
invest in those. And but
I don't know. I can't imagine having enough water to where if it was running off, you wouldn't be like, oh,
yeah, I
panic.
think it's very different in the Western US
It
than it is in
is.
the East than it is in the Eastern US.
Yeah.
Yeah, I
Yeah, it
think
really
there's
is.
a
Yeah. And for us too, like we run, if something runs off, it's like it's just going to go down the bar ditch by the road. And I mean, it's not going into a lake.
but it may, because we have watersheds, it can still make
Well,
it into a body of water,
yeah.
right? It's
Well,
still
it
going to
might go,
go somewhere.
it'll go into a playa,
Yeah.
and then it will, but I think it'll be filtered by the time it, I don't, we just don't have that much water.
There's a, I haven't looked it up recently, but there's a website that you used to be able to go to where you could put a raindrop at a certain point and you could see where that raindrop would go, like how it would get to the ocean. And it was really fascinating. I can't remember the name of it, but it was a really fascinating application where you could see how
Oh my
water
gosh.
moves from the upper Midwest all the way down to the Gulf or the Pacific or the Atlantic, right? And so you could see how
I
that
got to look
water
that up.
moves. Yeah,
Yeah.
because it's, I mean, we want to think that it stops somewhere, but it really doesn't, right? Like it, if I, if we have runoff in Auburn, Alabama, it's going to get to the Gulf, right? Like it will end up there at some point. And there are, like, mercury, for example, which isn't really used a lot in agriculture, so most of that's coming from manufacturing and the industrial side of things. But it's all those are persistent, right?
Yeah.
Like, so those are persistent,
So
persistent
isn't
activity.
there, but there's something that like causes a certain type of algae bloom, the ag runoff, and then it
Nitrogen.
converts. Yeah. And then it creates that, it converts, I guess the microbes eat that and it converts to mercury.
I do not know that answer.
I
I'm
don't,
gonna
I
have to look
thought
it
that's
up
what I
though.
thought. I mean,
Okay.
I'm done. Don't quote me. You
No, I'm I
you can
won't,
like,
but I'm gonna have to look it up. So
I may be
that's
completely wrong about that, but
well, I listen, I'm all about like looking up something that I haven't heard of
but I
before. Well,
thought
I
that
mean,
that was what they were pointing to, the salmon being contaminated was from the bloom, the algae bloom that actually then the microbes were eating that, and then of course then they, discharge another chemical, right? And so
I am
yeah, so
fascinated. I'm gonna have to
I
look
may
it
be
up. I
wrong,
know that,
so
well, I mean,
email
the
me and be like,
algae
you were totally wrong.
but the algae bloom is real, right? Like
Right.
we know that what happens, the nitrogen that goes on fields in the upper Midwest makes its way down the Mississippi River and into the Gulf, and then we have algae blooms in the Gulf that are that hypoxic zone. That's what that's what they call it. And so that hypoxic zone is you don't want it, right? Like it's bad
Right.
for the fish and the other species in the Gulf. And so the upper Midwest has done a great job. Like Minnesota has a buffer law that you have to have a 60-foot buffer, I think that's what it is, around all your waterways. And so they have really made a concerted
Wow.
effort to really try to reduce that as part of their contribution to trying to reduce that nitrogen. And those are the same practices, right? So buffer strips, grass buffers, grass waterways, terraces, those are all practices that are also applicable to keeping pesticides where they're meant to be, right? And so there is this overlap between managing your nutrients in the water and also managing your
Right.
pesticides that are getting
Right.
into the water. So it's that overlapping space of conservation practices that NRCS, the Natural Resources Conservation Service, the USDA, a lot of your soil and water conservation districts, and other groups have been putting in over the years for nutrient management, soil health. That's been a big one with cover crops. And
Right.
those are all things that are also mitigation measures that keep pesticides
It's
where
all
they're meant to
overlapping.
be. Yep. So
Interesting.
it all overlaps. And I think the more we talk about the fact that these are just good production practices to be
Right.
doing, it doesn't matter. It doesn't really matter the reason if you're doing it for nutrient management or pest management, or
Right.
it's going to have a benefit to the water, to your terrestrial areas, there's going to be this benefit. And that's what we've been talking a lot about, is that these are the things that are being required as part of pesticides, as part of the
Right.
pesticide labels, are things that a lot of
Right.
growers are probably already
Already
doing
doing.
because they're trying to address all the resource concerns on their farms.
Right. So as you're talking to growers, what is their, is there a like kind of a preconceived idea about what's happening, and then are they surprised, or are they frustrated with what feels like increased regulation?
I think it's the initial shock, right? Is that I think change is always hard, right? And so I think it's the initial shock. I think, and then once they kind of understand, and we've been having this discussion with growers at Commodity Classic since 22. And so we've really seen a change in understanding and a change in sort of opinion, I guess. And so I think when we first started talking to growers, it was, they were a little bit worried, right? Not a little bit, because when they first started talking about it, EPA, it was a lot, there weren't a lot of options on how to get the points. And I think once EPA got feedback from the agricultural community of, listen, we're doing all of these things and you're not reflecting those, but they have the same benefit, I think that made growers a lot like understand, okay, there are a lot more options of how we can address this runoff besides the very limited view of it when it first came out.
Yeah, 'cause
And
was it I feel like it was kind of framed as they were going to get rid of all these pesticides, like you weren't going to be
yes,
able to
yeah.
use any of them. But
Yes,
that's really
yes.
not the case. It's just like, no, you can use them and you're probably already doing stuff to mitigate. And if you know, yeah. So and it seems like a pretty easy way to like figure out if you're following. I mean, you know what I mean? Like that
I
seems like a
think
pretty simple way to
the
figure out if you're following the.
yeah, I think the biggest challenge, and this is a challenge for a lot of growers, is that it is on a field by field basis. So it's not for your whole farm. It's field by field. So every field has to be meeting those points. You and this has been true for buffers forever.
Right,
Every
sure.
field has to have those buffers. And so it's the management part of it, of okay, we have to figure out the points for every single field. And that feels overwhelming when you could have 250, 300 fields, which is very common where I'm from because we have small fields, right? And
Exactly,
so
yeah.
when you're faced with, and you also have to think about it, like especially in the Western US where you have a lot of crops and you may be rotating crops every 6 months or something when you have your veggie crops, that is another. So I think it's not necessarily the requirements per se, but it's the complicating part of agriculture, right? So in the Pacific Northwest, where you may move your potatoes can't grow in the same place every five, like you have to move them around every 5 years, I think, or somewhere in there. So you're going to be moving it, and it may not be land you control. It may be land that you rent to be able to get it back to the land that you own. So it's in those relationships with your renters and your landlords. So it's really the management of doing this that I think complicates it. And I think
Yes,
that's where
exactly.
growers are, where really it's not necessarily the mitigations themselves, but it's how do you, and this is true, I think, for pesticide labels in general and probably nutrient management, is how do you manage it in the complex system that agriculture is in the United States, where we're not, most growers outside of certain areas are not growing monocultures, right? They're not growing one crop all the time. I mean, that's not true for, if you have tree crops, right? So your orchards, your vineyards, that's going to stay put. But for crops where you're having to move them around, I mean, my own family grows seven crops a year. So anywhere on the farm, we could have seven different crops growing at any one point in time. So how do we manage that from a, and what happens? I mean, this is the other thing. What happens if all of a sudden you have a pest outbreak that you've never had before? You go and get the product and it's a 9 point product, but every other product that you've used is only a 6 point product, right? So you've never, and so that's why we encourage people, okay, just see if you can get to 9 points on all your fields, right? So make the effort up front, Just try to get to 9 points on all your fields. That way you're covered. You have it done. It's going to stay the
Holy
same.
crap.
Yes.
So yeah, so man.
So
So y'all can see
that's
because
the
you're like, oh, I
problem.
need to use this, but now I gotta come up with a way to get 3 more points. And it's like too late in the year for me to do any of them. So I
So,
literally can't use this.
yep. So doing the work up front before you're ever faced with that situation of going ahead and figuring out, and there's ways to simplify it, right? So for my family, because I know what our production systems are, I know where we have what it looks like, I can go ahead and say, we have this production system. It doesn't matter what field I'm on, we're going to be growing it the same way. It's worth this many points. And I can go, I group my fields. So I say, I'm going to group all my non-irrigated fields together. I'm going to group all my fields where I'm growing corn this year together. I try to come up with a way to say, I want to go from 250 fields down to 4 production systems
Do you
so
seriously
that
have 250 fields?
I don't know how many we have, but we have a lot. Yeah, we have a lot. But I did work with a grower who had almost 300 fields, individual fields. It's a lot because they, and they're not big. Some of them might only be 5 acres, right? Some of them might be 35 acres. Some of them, but we're not, you know, the Southeast is not the Midwest, right?
I
So,
know, well,
or
or
Texas.
here, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm just like,
And
I mean, that's kind of way it was in Poland. It was like, you know, there's like these 20-acre, and they rent, but they'll have a different landlord for every 20 acres too.
It is
Whoa.
possible. Yeah. And so, and we have such a high, not just in the United States in general, we have a very high percentage of rented land that
Oh
growers
yes.
manage. And so, and then I think a conversation I had with aerial applicators is that, you know, they can handle the buffers. That's not a problem. But they need to know what the growers are doing on the ground because they can't, if the product
9 points, they gotta
requires
know.
they need to know if it
Wow.
requires points. So those are conversations that I think aerial applicators are already starting to have. I know I worked with some in Wisconsin. They're already starting to have those conversations with the people they fly with. So I think that there's a lot of tools out there. EPA's put out some tools. They have an Excel spreadsheet. They have a tool called PALM, PALM on their website that growers can go ahead and start. If you know you're not using a product that's out there, if it's if you look at the label and it doesn't have mitigation points on it, or it doesn't have the new spray drift language, if it's not come out in the last since like late 2024, then you can look at those and you can say, okay, I know I don't have these points, but I could go ahead and go into this tool and see how many points I could get for, say, let's say you're growing cotton and sorghum. Right, and you do a winter fallow, or you do wheat in the winter, whatever that looks like. You could go ahead and say, okay, if this is my system, and I know that I'm doing no-till, or I know that I'm doing that double crop, which we can do in the South, right? In some parts of Texas, some parts might be too dry to do that double crop, but you can go ahead and set up that production system, and you can go ahead and figure out those points based on the counties where you're farming. So having those upfront conversations
Yeah,
with
do it. You
your,
need it. That's
yeah.
just another, you know, maybe even multiple days of research and management. But once it's done, it's done, you know. Yeah, that's really interesting. So man, that's complicated. And I can see now why they would say you won't be able to use certain pet, you're just not gonna be able, this is not gonna be able to use them anymore. But because they're not actually saying you can't use them, they're saying you can use them, but under these circumstances, which they've always had, but it's just a little more in depth now. And so,
Just a little different. It's just a different conversation.
yeah, interesting,
And I
golly.
think, I mean, you know, there's always been these changes to labels. You know, we had the worker protection standards. There's always been these new things as we gain more information, as we become more aware. There's always going to be changes. And so I think that because this is not self-implementing, right? It's not like they're going to snap their fingers and this is going to be on every label. It is a slow roll.
It's going to roll out
So,
slowly.
yeah.
Yeah.
So growers are going to see it. It's going to be first on new active ingredients. So not necessarily new products. So not necessarily products that are already registered, like products that have active ingredients that are already registered, but it's going to be on new
New
active
active
ingredients.
ingredients.
Yeah, so things that are just coming out. That's where it's going to, that's where it is showing up first, would be products that are new to the shelf. So let me rephrase that. Active ingredients that are new to the
New.
shelf.
Okay. Okay.
And
So
so,
the tool that EPA has, is it something where like a farmer could, I don't know, I just keep thinking with AI and all the things, like it'd be great to have like some kind of app that's like you implement the practice that you've done, and then if you put in like here's what I'm gonna do, like something that's, is it pretty simple and easy to like keep up with and
it is. They
okay.
have an Excel spreadsheet. They also have a PDF that you can just print out and write on. I think they're trying to meet the growers where they are of what's going to work best for them. The Palm tool is a web app. It's not necessarily an
Okay,
app
it's
for
not an
your
app.
phone.
Yes,
It's
okay.
a web app. But I think that there are, without naming names, there are groups out there who are
Yeah,
working
we're working on developing
on
something.
apps and different software that could be incorporated into your, I think crop consultants are already using a lot of software that can give them information like the soil types in the field, the slope of the field. So I think that once people dive in and learn about it, then they can find that out.
Okay, great. Man, this has been good. It's been
Sorry.
great.
Yeah, it's this has been a great conversation. I
It
appreciate it.
always is. And so I think we should just keep doing them because it's just so much fun. And I
Well, I
learn a
always
lot.
enjoy talking to you.
I
So,
learn a lot. So, I will see you probably on the
next week.
25th, 24th, 26th,
Yes,
something like
I'm flying in Monday, so I'm coming in a little bit
Okay.
early. I've got some meetings I have to do, but yes, I will be
Okay.
there and I can't wait to meet you in person.
It's gonna be great. It's gonna be great.
Yes, absolutely.
Yep. Okay. Well, friends, thanks for joining us again for another conversation about pesticides, EPA, and all the things that you need to know. So remember, even if you are going out to your shed and you're grabbing that weed be gone, it has a label. You should
Has
read
a
it.
label.
You should read it. We'll see you next time. Thanks, friends.